Welcome, movie lovers, back for another Anatomy of Movie. Today we go back in time as we talk about the creation of the scary doll that is known as Annabelle. So stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right. We have another horror-filled anatomy for you. For those of you who don't know, my name is Phil Svitek, and alongside me, Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans. Hey, Phil.
Hey, hey.
How's it going?
It's going great.
We are missing Marissa today.
Well, she's frightened. She hates horror, so she's scared under the closet somewhere.
She does, and I don't know if you know, but she did the first Annabelle movie and actually saw that Annabelle movie with Marissa. Brenda, we took her to a horror movie. She said she doesn't like it. And I have to say, it was really fun making fun of her watching a horror movie. Very easy to get. So, but miss her here today. But she's here in spirit.
That's right. So we're talking about the one and only Marissa Serafini, who is our lovely third co-host. Normally, for those of you just joining us for the very first time, welcome. If you're returning, welcome back. We appreciate you. Just the same, a couple of things. Understand that it's going to be spoiler-filled. We assume that you've seen the movie, so we're going to talk about it at length. We're going to talk about not only the plot lines, but also the behind-the-scenes and so forth. Additionally, if you want to follow along, in the description box, we have a link to our show notes, meaning the research we've done on these movies, so you can sort of dive in even deeper, because we're going to talk about these things, but we might not fully read them verbatim. Without further ado, let us begin, as we always do, with our quick thoughts for the movie, beginning with Dimitri.
Well, you know, I am a horror fan. I've been, you know, The Conjuring, the first one, really, you know, injected life into horror, James Wan and team. And to think that they were doing this offshoot, this Annabelle, you know, and now we're into Annabelle creation. Okay, and this is a sequel to the Annabelle movie that came out, I think it was 2 years ago or so. And for me, this movie, Annabelle Creation, has done what rarely so few horror sequels have ever done, and that is be better than their predecessor. It sort of kind of reminded me of that movie, Ouija 2, Origin of Evil, not just because they shared the same star actress, Lulu Wilson, but because the first Ouija was a piece of crap. And the second one, I was like,
it was a pleasant surprise.
Movie. It was a pleasant surprise. This movie to me was a pleasant surprise. I wasn't as big a fan of the first Annabelle. I thought it was horror by rote. But this one, they injected new life into it. I think a lot of it had to do with David F. Sandberg as the director, who did Lights Out. Again, a clever little horror movie. And along with Maxime Alexander, her cinematographer, and their editing, they seamlessly made it part of the Conjuring universe. And just little flares, like Sandberg's movement of the camera was very James Wan-esque, okay? The way that it looked. We had little tie-ins, like the black squid ink vomit, you know, ties into The Conjuring. So all these little things, these little details, if you've been watching The Conjuring movies, you know, they put it seamlessly into this universe, which I really appreciated. Also, it had the scares. I mean, this movie made me jump. It was a roller coaster ride. What a good horror movie should. The audience I saw it with was getting into it. I've said this before, between comedy and horror, those are some of the best types of movies to go to because the audience crowd and involvement. So it looked good. And then finally, the cast and performances were really good. I say this in my review that performance, I feel, is very important in a horror movie. I know you're going to say it's very important in every movie, but in a horror movie, if it's over the top, Then the movie becomes cheesy, and the movie becomes campy.
Yeah,
you've got to care, and I've got nothing wrong with camp if that's the way the director wants to go. But in a movie like an Annabelle, when you look at some your classic horror movies, They take it for real. No one phoned in anything. And you get more invested into the characters and you care. And that's through performance. So I think the performances in this movie, the look of this movie, sound design in this movie was awesome. So I'm a big fan. I really enjoyed Annabelle Creation, and I look forward to the expansion of this Conjuring universe. Yeah.
Well, you know, for me, I'm more of I knew the Insidious chapters, but Conjuring kind of just went by me. I didn't get involved, not because I wasn't looking forward to anything like that. I just kind of went by me. So this is my first foray into this, and you know what? I picked a good movie to start with because it's the creation of it all, or at least Annabelle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't lost or anything like that, and it made it very simple. I appreciated the fact it was you know, we'll talk about this, but the sort of Western element of being out in the
Nowhere.
House that they were. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that because it not only blended those horror elements, but also kind of that Western feel.
Yeah.
Except the bad guy, the gunslinger, is a doll that's about to kill you.
So it
changes up a little bit. And overall, you know, when you talk about, I think in terms of acting, I think like comedies, you can say it's a matter of timing.
Sure.
This is a matter of subtlety, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, you're doing very particular movements, you're doing very particular things with your head, your body, and so forth. And so if that's played too, you know, it's, you know, it has to be done right, and it's the art is in the subtlety.
It is, and it's about taking the subject matter seriously. Think about it, and think about like John Carpenter's Halloween. If his three leads, like if they were just bad actresses and they hammed it up, you don't care. Think about movies like The Exorcist. Had they not had Linda Blair, or they pick somebody else to be Father Marin, or they just get somebody, you know, who's just not right for the role, or maybe they cheese it up, the horror really doesn't work as well or as much because they're playing towards sort of silliness. Mm-hmm. So, and again, there are certain horror movies where I'll buy silliness, you know, some of the Friday the 13th sequels and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But performance matters in a horror movie if you want to truly be scared, because you need investment in said characters. You need sympathy, because part of that tension relies on you caring whether or not they're going to make it.
One of the things that I certainly want to talk a lot more in depth about is are the characters that they set up, because they're vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a good range of little girls to, you know, almost adults, if you will. In a simple sense, something that was there underneath was this notion they want to be loved and adopted.
Right.
But at the same, you know, I don't think there was any notion from the older girls, you know, not that they outright said it, but, like, they know their lot in life. Like, they're going to hit... They're going to become adults, and then they're going to go off into the world. They're not getting adopted, essentially. They just know that.
That's an interesting point that you bring up, because in all honesty, I wasn't necessarily – I was so focused on our two young characters, Janice and Linda, and the nun. Mm-hmm. The older kids, you're right. I never thought of it that way, and they were good, the actresses who portrayed them. But you're right. You did get the sense that – now thinking back on it, that they definitely sort of kind of knew their lot in life, and
yeah.
This is just another halfway house for them, so to speak. But yet, a horror haunted house that they all pool together to try to get out.
Yeah.
You know,
and so I'll give a little bit of the backstory, and then we'll talk about the, because I'm dying to dive into the story, but
yeah.
So quite interesting, you know, they wanted to make the sequel very early in 2015. They confirmed, like, hey, let's do a sequel. And they were looking into it, and they James Wan saw early cuts of Lights Out, or at least almost the near completed.
Mm-hmm.
Which
he produced.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And so David Sandberg, he was the director of that, and I can't praise that movie enough.
Yeah.
It really came out of nowhere. It was a breath of fresh air in the horse. It just tells
you
everything.
Agree with you. And when you think about James Wan, right? It's funny because I sort of switch around this famous Disney quote, Walt Disney, where, you know, where it all began with a mouse, with James Wan, with him, where it all began with a doll. And I'm talking the Saw doll. Okay, so his foray into horror, he's been doing it a lot, and he's very successful. And then with The Conjuring, he reinvents the haunted house genre, makes it an investigative story. When he's choosing directors in a movie like Lights Out, you know, he just knows. Like, this guy, David F. Sandberg, picks up James Wan cues. One of the big things in Lights Out, not only was it the lights, but it was the sound of the switch going click, click, click. He uses sound to his advantage in horror, much like he does in Annabelle. And he was a perfect choice, I think, for having him go from this little clever horror movie that delivers scares and jumps to have him do this, to have him do Annabelle Creation. I thought it was a wise choice.
You know? Absolutely. And, you know, what also was evident is that David really appreciates the horror genre, and so he didn't want to do a formulaic thing, but then he was blown away by the script, and he really saw, well, it's not going to be formulaic. Yes, there's going to be tropes that, as he said, you know, we'll dive into deeper the technique, but, you know, the James Wan tropes are part of that, but that excited him rather than like, ooh, you know, it's going to be formulaic.
Right, and I think, for me anyways, I think that's what hurt the first Annabelle movie. And I don't want to diss the gentleman who directed that, because I believe he's James Wan's cinematographer for The Conjuring and such, but he didn't have the flair that James Wan had has and exhibits, and I was expecting more of that. And he seemed to just fall back on what we already know of horror to make people jump. David F. Sandberg, on the other hand, really, you know, you could tell that he loves horror. And while he doesn't repeat James Wan, but you can tell he's cut from that same cloth. I find it very fascinating that we're talking about a movie where Annabelle the doll, while it had some part in the original Conjuring, right? Had some part, but it wasn't the main part of the movie. But yet it has, for lack of better words, a life of its own, right? And I just find that it's, so you came up with an Annabelle movie that tells the next chapter of this doll. I was always wondering, how did the Warrens get involved with the doll? I thought that was going to be a Conjuring sequel, right? You go forward, or if you're going back, that's because we set up the Warrens so great. Let's find out how their case went with this doll. But no, after that movie, they decide to go even further back. and you go to the, you know, to Creation. And I want to talk about this because I want to talk about an interesting article I read from the Hollywood Reporter that talked about horror sequels. I think going back sort of kind of helps. It helps within the Conjuring universe, what they did. And again, I think they just delivered a scarier movie. And it doesn't take away from the bite of the doll. When you go to watch The Conjuring, which I strongly urge that you do, when you see the doll, it's not going to take away from the bite of the scares of what that doll can do. So they again, along with the writer as well, they did a very, very good job of, you know, Gary Dauberman. They really took their time to put it into the universe and make it somewhat seamless, even more so than the first Annabelle, I felt.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to that, but I know on the whole, it just, it stood alone, you know, and that was the great part is, you know, it was enjoyable. Well, it was horrific from start to finish.
Yeah.
In that way.
And let me ask, like, how many horror movies, like, especially if it's a sequel, unless it's like a Friday the 13th, you could pretty much jump into those anywhere. But for any sequel, for it to literally, like, this does stand alone. You don't need prior knowledge.
Believe it or not, I think they've, you know, in the overall spectrum of things, they've done a good job, because I saw Insidious 2 before Insidious. And then Chapter 3 of Insidious, that's a standalone bit because it's before the events of Insidious 1 and 2.
Yeah.
So I think they know within their wheelhouse how to do these movies where they fit part of a larger whole, or, hey, you want to piecemeal it, have at it.
Yeah, and And it's great, too, because James Wan also brought us Insidious, which is another fine horror trilogy that delivers originality. It delivers shocks, twists. Mm-hmm. It's a good, I mean, that, too, is another strong horror entry from James Wan. I like his stuff. I get that he's doing other things. You know, I think he's working on Aquaman right now. But we have video of him talking about Annabelle and horror. And I like listening to him because he seems to be like this generation's almost John Carpenter. But he loves talking about the genre. He has a passion, and that means that always, I don't know, I think it comes through in his movies.
Yeah.
You know.
So why don't we play that clip if we can. Anthony, our engineer in the booth. Cue it up.
James Wan, producer.
Just let us know when you got it ready.
Yeah, just have Brady hit play.
All these the audience doesn't know all these names.
He's my dog.
He's in like the booth. Marissa, Brady, Anthony, who the hell are these people?
Artifact room is the idea that each of these haunted artifact that the Warrens have quote-unquote confiscated through their years of paranormal research and investigation, that they've kind of collected and put it into and housed it inside, like, you know, like this room in their basement someplace. It just became an organic thing that you started asking, going, I wonder what was the story behind this artifact? And then you go, I wonder what was the story behind this other artifact? And then it became, you know, then we thought, you know, wouldn't it be a great idea that at some point, you know, if we are successful and lucky enough, we can spin off all the different stories and go and touch on the different artifact and in essence, basically opening up a much bigger world. And I think the Conjuring universe has really blossomed from that, and it came from a place that was pretty organic to begin with.
Now, what I
we
love,
always knew that.
Let's hit pause for a sec because I wanna comment on what he says because I think it's very important, especially of movies from this summer. He says, if it were successful and if we were lucky enough for it to be successful, I'm sure when Warner Brothers decided to release The Conjuring, they didn't have an idea that it was going to be as big as it was, right? But they knew that it was cheap to make. I'm sure they tested it. They had the goods. They knew it. They marketed it well. It becomes this really big horror hit of that summer. And the organic way that this became a franchise wasn't, ooh, we got to map this all out right now. No, James Wan delivered a good movie. And he thought, well, wow, the Warren's basement. Like, that's the way that I think studios should start approaching their movies that are not books that they've acquired and bought or they've pre-bought a quote-unquote franchise. Work on making a really good movie. And with luck, and if it's successful, then think of the ways to develop said movie into either offshoots, franchises, because Conjuring is the way that movies became franchises in like the 80s and whatnot. And even farther back, you made a good movie, people liked it, let's make another one. And this one, and when you think about it, it's an offshoot of The Conjuring because it's about a doll. That, again, takes up a whole of maybe 10 minutes in The Conjuring. That, to me, is fascinating. But I think studios should look at the organic way of developing new franchises. Make a good movie first.
Oh. At this point, unfortunately, I think a lot of studios are more marketing machines rather than creative machines.
Well, no, you're right.
How do we start marketing for something? You know, we got to market 5 years out as opposed to X, Y, and Z, and so it's...
But my point is then, you know, yeah, it was a good risk for Warner Brothers to say, let's release The Conjuring. It's not associated with any other movie, right? Let's see what happens. And they did, and catapulted Leigh Whannell and James Wan, and, you know, and now Insidious, and which isn't necessarily part of that universe, but with Annabelle, now we're getting a wider, bigger Conjuring universe. And so far, I'm enjoying it, you know. So, but they did it organically, as James Wan said. So.
I like it better than the Dark Universe, that's for sure.
Well, there you go.
I won't go more into depth than that. I'll leave it at that.
But that's the difference. There wasn't any organicness to that, that they tried to make it organic, where The Conjuring here has been all organic. Yeah. So
let's get into the story a little bit. I'm trying to think of, like, the beginning to me was done so interestingly because in some sense, you know, like, when you open up on that workshop,
yeah,
it's supposed to be so loving and tender, and yet there's just that element of creepiness because you know it's coming. Like, at no point, unless you go into this completely blind and you've never been told anything, you know, like, ooh.
Right. There's definitely that presence.
Yeah.
Of darkness, because, yeah.
It kind of, I don't know, for me it was very unsettling because I'm like, these dolls are going to children.
Right.
And these are children's toys.
Yep.
And we're about to see what goes wrong.
What can go wrong. What I liked about it is, number one, the movie's a period piece, right? It takes place out in Monument Valley-esque West isolation. This man's a toy maker, Mullins, Anthony LaPaglia's character. And you did get a sense while he was making his dolls that there was a sense of pride, you know? And people were waiting. There was that great scene when they come out of church and one of the shop owners, when's my shipment? When do we get my dolls? And his wife's like, oh, you'll have them next Monday. He's just finishing it. But he so lovingly painted it and then so made sure that this is number one of 100. Limited edition, had the stamp on it. So even back in this period, that craftsmanship, it was important. It wasn't manufactured in a store, in a factory. There was a lot of tender, loving care put into making these dolls that might make somebody happy.
Which, by the way, you know, as you kind of go through it, the stuff that I was always looking at was even in her room, whether it's the dollhouse and all these things, I would assume that he made for her.
Right.
Right? And so it just brings in that element where, obviously, he's a great toy maker and so forth, but by doing that, it showed the love that he does have for the daughter. Because that, you know, A, that takes a lot of work. B, in essence, that takes time away from him, especially the way they portrayed it. It's taking time away from him actually working and earning money, in a sense.
I took it as everything that he built for her was an inspiration to perhaps build, like, she got the prototypes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you like this, honey? Like, she was his muse.
Okay, that's
and,
a good way.
And I took it as, like, that, for me, too, makes the loss of B more, because he more or less stopped doing what he's doing. I took his daughter to be his muse, to make her these things, and then he would gauge, well, this dollhouse could be good to make, and I can, you know. So she would, you know, she was the test, but she was the inspiration, mm-hmm. I felt, because he loved doing this job. And I sort of got that in that opening scene. And you're right, all the dolls in the room, it just, the light that came into a room, you know, there was that innocence that you could tell that there was a love between the parents and B, which makes the loss of her so much more tragic.
Absolutely.
So,
and that was the one part that, you know, if I had to, like, really nitpick that I disliked is when they did the car crash, a doll comes down as opposed to her body. And in the grand scheme of the timeline, that's not how it worked. And so I was just a little bit thrown off by that, and didn't quite appreciate it. Like, I thought it was clever, and I knew what they were going for, but I'm like, okay, what does that really mean?
I just took it as, it's harsh, and it's one of those, I don't want to see the aftermath of a little girl getting hit by a Mack truck. It's sort of, that scene sort of reminded me of a scene of a more modern movie, Pet Sematary, which their son Gage gets hit by an Ornco truck, Stephen King's Pet Sematary. And it was sort of set up almost in the same way. They weren't fixing a car, but the little girl goes walking out to get the ball, and Yeah, I thought the way they handled it was fine because they made it right at the right cut where you knew. And I like also like how they set it up, too. They actually showed that truck, like, way in the background. And if you saw the trailer, you know what's coming, but you see the truck and you're like, that sense of dread just comes in because you know where this is going. And I didn't need to see the remains of the girl. I actually sort of kind of liked that European sort of kind of cut. It was a little artistic that you get, but
I didn't need the girl and I didn't need the doll is what I'm saying. Like, you know what I mean?
As but soon they as just cut.
Yeah. Cause to your point, as I'm seeing the truck, I don't need to see what happens. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear cut what's about to happen.
It is.
If it came out of nowhere, maybe I'd be a little bit confused, but yeah, you know, right from the get go, what's about to happen.
Oh yeah.
The interesting choice that I thought they made was when the orphans and the sister are coming to here, our only voice from the outside world is really this bus driver.
Right.
And he doesn't really, like, I thought that was an interesting choice that they never go into town and things like that. We contain it to this house. Smart choice. But it was interesting, you know, looking back on it, the information that they chose to convey during that bus ride versus, because, you know, he definitely could have prepped them, like, it's, listen, this house has a whole weird history, X, Y, and Z. You know, I'd love to see it again to see if, like, he's perhaps holding back some of that information because he knows, like, hey, they've got nowhere else to go. And so let me just try to make the best of the situation because why scare them?
Yeah. And that's the way I took, like, a lot of that. I mean, that bus ride up to, well, number one, it sets up a lot of things. It sets up, I always forget that nun's name. I have to, Sister Charlotte, played by Stephanie Sigmund, who I thought she was great. But it sets up Sister Charlotte. It sets up the girls, but more importantly, it sets up the very deep sister-like relationship. Not, they weren't just, like, the best friends. They were in a sense sisters, and their relationship, and you pretty much right on that bus scene understood, because they made that almost like pinky promise that wherever you go, I'm going. Wherever you go, I'm gonna go with you. We're a package deal, and you know I really liked the way that it set up, and the two actresses I thought were great. You know, you believed in them, and they knew that they were going to this house, and who knows what's going to happen. And you talked about the isolation. My whole thing is, how does anybody know that these girls are out here? I mean, they are literally out in the middle of nowhere, seemingly. Who's going to know that this is also an orphanage? But regardless, it was a place for them to go, and it was sunnier and brighter at the beginning. It was fulfilled with hope and promise.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, the downstairs was much, much more brightly lit. And even when they go upstairs initially, there's light coming through the windows and everything of that nature, so.
And the stained glass color. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're very hopeful at that point in time.
Yeah. I mean, at least for our characters. Anybody who's seen a good horror movie every now and then know that something's going to happen. It's called Annabelle Creation. The doll's going to have to show up.
Well, you know, and that's part of the trickery. But I thought, you know, in terms of Samuel Mullins, he played it very interesting because he was just so distanced from the girls.
Right.
Part of it, looking back on it, they wanted to have that sense of, like, we've moved on in our lives. And you know what? Part of that is, like, instead of, like, we need to insert life into this place. And so what better than, you know, a bunch of girls? And you're doing a good thing. You're feeling like, okay, we're atoning, essentially, for whatever, however guilty they feel for, A, the death, B, you know, the doll.
Mm-hmm. What I liked about Samuel Mullins, Anthony Leopaglia, and Mrs. Mullins, Miranda Otto, at that point in time, Anthony LaPaglia played it so stern and depressed, okay? And I was going to be really? You really thought that this might have been a good idea for you folks? I mean, I know it's been 12 years. You know, when you're grieving, there's no set time piece or time watch on that. But at least that conversation happened in the movie. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we did the right thing. And I was appreciative of that. Because as an audience member, I'm watching it, and I'm like going, dude, these are girls. Like, you could be a little, I don't know, happier that they're there. But you just, like, you were grumpy and you're sort of a little short as you're giving them a tour. And this is supposed to be a new beginning. And I was like, wow, maybe not the best idea. They address it in the movie. And I thought that was very smart. And he, as the movie progressed, he seemed to soften up a little towards at least Linda and Janice, being, you know, she had her polio affliction. However, the introduction into the house, that was a great one shot.
Mm-hmm.
Very well choreographed, the way the camera went in and how
people moved about
from one to another, out of frame, back into frame, opening up. This is the pantry. This is the kitchen. Very cleverly done. And make something that's a tour of a house could be sort of kind of boring. But it made it, it did it with a flair that I was like, oh, wow, okay. It didn't take me out of the movie.
Well, it matched the excitement of the girls.
Yes.
That's what it really did. Because, yes, you could achieve that with cuts, but this is just, you know, where they're nonstop. You know, the camera reflected that nonstop.
Yeah. And it was very well done. Very well done. And then you also get the sense, too. So we have Janice, who was, you know, partially stricken by polio. So she's really not able to walk well. And how are we going to make it upstairs? Can we, you know, and that's brought up, too. And the chair comes down. And you go, well, all right, there was thought put into this. And that you sort of kind of get, too. Like, okay, they knew that this was coming. I forget if that chair had been used by Esther Mullins.
They said it was, which I'm not entirely sure about, only because I think he could have been saying that as just a way of like, hey, you know, we didn't build this. I don't know. Although, like, you know, yes, there's one that you could say, like, hey, we built it for you to make her feel special. But I think in this case, she didn't want to be singled out.
Mm-hmm.
And so just to say, like, hey, we just always had it, it makes her feel like, okay, I'm part of everybody. Like, in that sense, to keep her as part of a group was a better thing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know, and that was a side where, despite his early on actions, I was like, oh, he's sweet.
Yeah.
You know?
And the chair ride up, too, was a very well, like, I felt, directed scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, following her up. And there's a scene when she gets up and there's the negative space. Like, there's the darkness there. But, again, through cinematography, too, the way that we're going up, there's this red stained glass that seems to be on the banister that the camera was going through, and James Wan loves using red in his movies as a sign of there be demons here. So there's that, the first sense of dread that we're sort of getting is when we're looking through that red. I just thought, again, it was just very well played. Where other times, she goes up, oh, all right, great, it works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they took time, and that's another thing I liked about this movie. It took time to set up. We didn't get all our scares out of the trailer, but each one, it worked itself up to it.
And to that point, you know, they made a very conscious effort to avoid as many jump scares. So there's a couple, you know, and I think part of it is now they played with the idea, because people are expecting jump scares, that they played on the notion, hey, we're gonna basically push as much as we can without giving you the jump scare.
Right.
So I thought that worked well. And yeah, you know, to be able to do that, you have to kind of manipulate time in the right way. One of the more brilliant parts of it was, you know, going into that room and the way she was able to do it. you know, you can sort of, you can date it back to who you want, but really, to me, it comes back to that Hitchcock vertigo effect.
Yes.
Where, you know, you're really getting a, it's obviously, you know, movies, you can't really get a first-person perspective.
Right.
This allowed that, at least in that brief moment, to see, oh, things are really distorted, and I don't know what's going on.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's direction, obviously, to cinematography. But, you know, it's funny, because you had mentioned something early on, and David Sandberg actually cements your argument. He goes, he viewed this film a little bit like a Western movie. Because of the exteriors, we had to work without on a farm, a legitimate farm somewhere out in California. I have the location and all, but it's open and dusty. It was almost desert-like. And along with the cinematographer, Maxime Alexander,
mm-hmm.
He was able to capture that in the film CinemaScope imagery. So you do get that, the beautiful CinemaScope, but you also understand the isolation that they're at, because there's, you know, it takes them time to get into town. The exteriors of the farmhouse, believe it or not, they were primarily shot location at this place called Big Sky Ranch in Simi Valley, which is about 30 miles from downtown LA. They used an existing structure, and the production department, they just modify it with white clapboard to give it a gothic look to it. They also had to, even though it was a Western sensibility, that setting apparently came with its own horrors. They had to have wranglers come in daily to sweep it out of rattlesnakes and tarantulas that were hiding in the grass, because most of that cast, particularly the girls, are outside, you know, right, playing in the grass. So that's how desolate, you know, this area was. So, yeah, it was well played. So we had those lovely exteriors, and then they bring it inside. And what I love is, like, it was primarily shot on the Warner Brothers studio lot, stage 26.
You get to control lighting, and, you know, it just makes it a little bit easier.
And that's what they said. It was all about pulling out walls, getting the camera into spaces that we needed it to be in. It was all on a soundstage. The walls that could come out, as I said, cameras could fit, cranes, whatever they needed, they could do there. And the house itself was a two-story design American Gothic farmhouse. And they sort of kind of built the sets like a single story. They built them like side to side, which is so cool, because I never would have. That's great movie magic in editing, you know. So I actually think that's pretty cool, even though it's two stories. But here we are.
You know, in terms of this ties in both story and design. How often, like, all the horror generally happens in the basement, right? And this is really the first movie, and I'm sure there's others. So if there are, feel free to, you know, comment. I'd be interested, but this is really upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also not the attic, because it's generally the attic or the basement,
right?
And so it's that and that is a creepiness to it, because it's like, okay, this was her room,
right?
And this is where the evil's coming from. And I really appreciate how they set that up. And you know, it's not a jump scare, but the way they portrayed her initially, just kept that door kept opening, and
yes.
and then. You know, this ties into the production side. They really thought of, okay, how do we get a doll to really move in a way that's creepy, and also you're not having to stare at the doll. And so initially, just having that sheet over her head, that was creepy in and of itself.
Absolutely,
because we already got the creepiness of the doll,
right? And you know, it's funny, because this is something that while I was watching this movie, I'd mentioned John Carpenter before. That is a very popular John Carpenter horror fallback. He used it in Halloween when Michael Myers has the ghost thing, but he uses it in The Fog, and he used it in The Thing, where there's something that's covered, but underneath the cover you see movement. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, can be scarier than the actual, like, the actual thing, the actual body.
Well, this is, it, it's almost like kind of like that a Schrodinger's cat, where you know that, but in the sense you know there's something creepy underneath,
right?
But until you pull it off, right. Is it the doll? What is it?
What is it? Yeah, and it, yeah,
and it, so you don't know.
No, it's a great. Again, this is why this I think the movie has flair and works very well as they show us something. They give us scares that are earned. Mm-hmm. And you're right. What's under there? Who's under there? Why are they under a sheet?
Yeah. And also at that point in time, you don't necessarily know the motive, which, I want to get your opinion on. I thought it was very interesting. There's that battle of like, okay, do they go after the weakest person? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did feel for Janice in that way, and Sister Charlotte was trying to help her in that sense. Like, no, you're just as great as everybody else. And I really felt for her because there was that sense of isolation. Like, she didn't get to play with the girls. And as much as, you know, when you talked about that bus bond between her and Linda, Linda has no problem going and playing by the well with the rest of the girls.
Right.
But the irony is, obviously, she's kind of that in between where she doesn't fit into either
right.
at that point because, you know, they play hide and go seek and they don't care about her at all.
I think you bring up, I think that's a really good question on a couple of levels. From a horror standpoint, when we're talking about possession, I always will go back to, say, The Exorcist. Regan was possessed because of innocence. I mean, remember, that family there was a very agnostic family. Didn't necessarily even, believe, but the youth of Regan was innocence. And so it wasn't, I think, with Janice, I don't think it was that she was weak. I do. Like, Sister Charlotte was she was an amazing role model for these women. And I love the way that she was played because she wasn't that stringent, wrap you on the knuckles nun that we can sometimes get in these, you know, in almost any movie, but particularly a horror movie. She was very motherly, and she gave good anecdotes, and she used by example. And she told her, said, no, you're probably the strongest. I believe in any case, if there was going to be a possession taking place, I believe it was because Janice was the most true-hearted, I believe. Of the kids, there was Janice, and then there was Linda. Mm-hmm. And I think that, if I'm going to theorize as to why, I think it was...
for that reason.
Yeah, because she had the best heart, and because she was strong, and because of her innocence, I believe. So, yeah. And it makes it all the more horrific, too.
It does, and, you know, it kind of echoes the Mullen story, where it came from a good place, where, you know, at first, I mean, because she only saw the daughter, she's trying to, in some sense, solve this mystery, if you will.
Right.
And so were they. You know, they saw their daughter, like, oh, wait, we have to help. This isn't obviously not natural, but we have to help her.
Right.
And so that came from a good place. And unfortunately, when it just comes to the supernatural, just don't.
Right.
There is no good in supernatural.
Yeah, and then this movie does something else, too, that's sort of kind of rare. They set up... There are two mysteries. There's the... What's going on in that bedroom? What are all the sounds going on? And then we have Esther Mullins.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to her? Like, what? Why is she in that room? What tragedy befell her where she's bedridden and she wears a Phantom of the Opera-esque type mask?
Rings what happened? A bell.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, when you talk about sound design, that was...
She rings a bell. Yeah. She rings a bell, like, for service, so to speak, which... Also, I believe it was it Insidious 3? Girl with a broken leg had to ring a bell, too. That was another sound thing.
I forget off the top of my head, but maybe.
But in any case, yeah, it was. I believe it was Insidious
3. The guy's worst
3.
Nightmare, by the way.
Yeah. Jeez. But now we have another mystery that is also creepy. Like, this is like, well, like, what happened? Like, why does she hide half of her face? And it all ties in as we learn what happened.
Well, part of it was either the question was, did, you know, because of the way Sam was interacting and because of that mystery that you're speaking about, did they lure them here on purpose?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was the interesting part to me. It was playing that game of, like, these are creepy people. And then to learn to have that switch of, no, they tried to do the best they could. And, you know, the reason why they're here is they're trying to atone for something that they did back in the day.
Right.
Which was good intention, that, you know, as it was.
Which is another, I think, strength of this movie is because, remember when you understand the pain of the loss of a child? And you understand why they would do something that would be so unorthodox. People try to do that today. That's what makes, in part, that's why a lot of mediums are popular. Because there's somebody who may have lost somebody. And they'll turn to a medium. I'm not saying, hey, whatever makes you comfortable. I'm not saying I believe, don't believe, whatever. Maybe not so much believe. But if it makes you happy, and if you think that it gives you comfort, I get it. I mean, albeit, you got to think, I've never known of a medium to tell a customer, oh, yeah, your husband's glad he's no longer with you and he's happier now, leave me alone.
Maybe some of them should.
Maybe. But I'm just saying, you understand why they took this supernatural, mystical type of route, or a route, I should say. And you get it. Like, you get it. And then because of that, things went very, very awry, and this demon, which is explored and talked about in The Conjuring, obviously Annabelle, the first movie. And again, I just found that it tied in very nicely, because this is an evil, evil, evil entity.
What I appreciated, I guess, and I don't know if that's the right term, but the girl who plays Stephanie Sigmund, she requested that the same ritual that was performed on Conjuring 2 was performed on set,
right.
On here, which is to get rid of the demons. And yeah. When you talk about, you know, about the mediums and things like that, it's interesting to learn that they did bring in Father Robert as a consultant on this movie. Now, his last name is not public because of the profession which he is in. He is an actual priest and exorcism expert. And the quote he gets, the levitation part doesn't come up every time you're doing an exorcism, but I have seen people who have been able to do things physically that you wouldn't see in normal life, he says. When somebody will have their feet on the floor and their hands back behind them, bent almost half in air, that would get anybody annoyed, I suppose. And he's not just an exorcist himself. He performs other rituals. He's on the Exorcism Institute in America.
Oh.
Which is a thing. He does deliverances. If they're speaking other languages that they normally wouldn't know, if they're levitating, if they have hidden knowledge of things, if they have, let's say, superhuman strength, then he's your guy.
Yeah, I wonder if he was used on the Conjuring movies.
I don't know. I didn't get more information
I didn't,
than that.
You know, I can't. Conjuring 2, I think, came out a couple of, maybe last year, a year and a half ago. But that, you know, that was about possession as well. But yeah, hey, listen, I think that if you're calling this a possession movie, it's done pretty well and scary, and you buy it. But again, the tragedy that befalls the Mullins, and it is tragic, it's on both ends. They're just trying to do something. And they go in, they look to their faith,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, to try to do this. They look to their faith to help them, and so that they can see B, their daughter. They just, lines got crossed severely, you know, and then they bring in this evil.
Well, it's one of the things that, you know, is never really explicitly stated in horror movies, but it's the old biblical thing where, you know, in times of great fears, obviously when the, you know, the devil prays, And so, you know, they took advantage of that, mm-hmm. you know, the supernatural, and this comes about.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because I think this was also brought up in the movie, is that they knew something wasn't quite right, but because they wanted it so badly, when the request came to, I want to go into the doll,
yeah.
they said, sure. You know, you have our permission. The other thing that they used is the little paper game.
Yes.
I'm looking for you.
Where are you?
Where are you? Find me. Okay. This is another James Wan type of trope that's used throughout. In Conjuring, again, it's more of a sound thing, but it was clapping. Mm-hmm. Okay. He brings this up at the beginning as a simple game. And in this movie, a simple game turns into a horrific simple game. It's like, and when you were able
to... Well, they even used that on Janice. That's what she did.
Yeah, so that's exactly what she did.
It was, you know, in the timeline of things, that was the middle portion. But obviously, in chronological order, that was the ending thing.
Yeah.
So,
but I love how you take something as simple and childlike, and you're able to make it very sinister. And it works. It worked a lot. So,
and that, you know, it was interesting that they, you know, as you kind of discuss it, the confession scene between Sister Charlotte and Janice.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it worked on multiple levels. One, it was very sweet when you talked about her as being able to navigate and really console these kids, especially her towards Janice. It was a very sweet moment.
I thought so.
But it also sets up the idea, to your point, the innocence of her. Right. Because, you know, as she says, like, I sin and things like that. And you're kind of, for me, you know, I'm unfortunately not of the faith, I will say.
Okay.
Certainly not to that degree. And so, you know, for me, it was like, okay, well, she was just being curious. And I kind of just brushed it aside, like, yeah, she was just being curious rather than sinning, but I think sinning is a harsh word. And now, if I take that same sentiment, but then hear the Mullins' story,
mm-hmm.
I would say they did a horrific thing, but no different than really what she did.
Right.
And so now I have to reevaluate how I judge this.
Yeah, what I really enjoyed about that scene that you were talking about, the confession scene, is... Again, Stephanie Sigmund as Sister Charlotte, you know, we could have had that stereotypical stringent nun, but instead she chose to go this more inspirational, this more motherly way. And we have a moral compass, right? We know because she was told do not go into that room, she shouldn't have gone into that room. We know that she was led into that room. The once locked door is now unlocked. So, but for the girl to understand that I took the sin as, you know, I did something wrong. Hmm. I went where I wasn't supposed to go. You know, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. And there's a bigger picture because she's starting to, through exposition, say something's not right. And Sister Charlotte, She almost even forgot to say, well, this is what you do, like, give your Hail Marys or what. But she was very motherly, and she was like, okay, you recognize you did wrong. Let's not do it again. We need, the Mullins are out of the kindness of their heart. I thought that played very, very sweet. And it gave us not only a sense of Janice, but it gave a better sense of Sister Charlotte as a mm-hmm. character. So I appreciate how that character was written and how it was performed by Stephanie Sigmund.
Absolutely.
She was really good. By the ways, I was looking at Sister Charlotte. And no, it's not a nun fantasy or anything. I know where you're going.
I was going to say, me too.
Look, she's an attractive woman. She is in the opening scenes of Spectre. Mm-hmm. James Bond Spectre. She's the woman that James Bond's walking through Mexico City with. And that one shot, that's a great shot, that ends up in a hotel bedroom. And then she's on the bed and where are you going? And that's when Jay goes, oh, out for a walk. That's her. I was like, oh my God, that's great. But yeah, nun fantasy aside, but she was very good in this role and very protective, and I'm glad they didn't kill her off.
Me too.
You know,
she lives to tell the story.
She lived to tell the story.
Kind of an interesting fact. So, the girl who plays Janice, her brother, he was in Lights Out. And by the way, she was considered early for Conjuring 2.
Right.
Didn't work out the way, but James Wan kept that in the back of his mind of like, you know, she'd be good for something. And it paid off for her. So, good for her. And obviously, you spoke of Lulu Wilson, you know, whether it's Deliver Us from Evil or the second Ouija movie. Quite an actress.
She really is, I have to say. And I was wondering, again, I think that maybe she's becoming the horror sequel good luck charm. Because when a sequel really has no right to be that good because its first movie wasn't that good, she's been in two movies where the sequel was better than. We actually have... she's as cute as a button, too, to listen. We have video of her talking about Annabelle, but she's great. And in Ouija, she was the possessed entity. She was horrific. If you haven't seen Ouija 2, number one, I suggest you see it. You don't need to see the first movie. But when you see Lulu Wilson in that movie, and then you see Lulu Wilson in this movie, and when you see her in real life, as we're about to, well, like real life on video, she's just so cute. You go, how could she have been that in Ouija? So, yeah, let's start off. Let's listen to her talk, because she's very, very cute and very fun to listen to.
Here we go.
I think she's scary because, well, this is about Annabelle doll, number one. She's ginormous, and her eyes, they literally follow you like the Mona Lisa. And even if you're, like, looking at her and you're like, oh, she's staring at me, I gotta move. When you're in that position and you look back at the Annabelle doll, she's still looking at you. And also the eyebrows, they're slanted in a way that it looks like she's always planning to get you. And it's really freaky.
We can keep going because
Sister Charlotte is basically Janice's family. And she feels that she has to do everything for Janice. And she has to care to her every need.
And this is about horror.
He's like a really awesome director. One of the best that I've worked with. And usually when you shoot a scene in a horror film, you don't feel like it's scary until you watch it, like with the music and everything. But when I'm doing the scene with David, he makes it feel really scary when I'm doing it, and that doesn't always happen.
So I think, I mean, it speaks to that because he let the scenes play out.
Right.
You know, the difference between Lights Out and this was he maybe he was kind of reacting to it, but... I don't know. I'd love to kind of hear him more, but he in essence didn't script this one out in terms of storyboards, in terms of how he's going to shoot it. He said, "We'll figure it out on set."
Right.
And obviously, by the result of it, it wasn't that he didn't know how to do that, or he was being like,
"Well, yeah." And we have good video of him too, which we can play. But I want to go back to Lulu's comments. There were a couple of things. The first time I was watching and picking out like video. That I got from the press kit. Number one, she compares like, oh, the eyes always follow you like the Mona Lisa. When did you see the Mona Lisa? I haven't even gone to see. I didn't even know the eyes followed you. The only thing I know that follows me are the two busts in the Haunted Mansion Library. But it's just really funny. She mentions Mona Lisa. And then I like how she talks about, well, in horror movies, when you're filming these things, you know, it's really not scary until they put... And, you know, she does it with such an innocence. And you can tell she loves doing what she's doing as a kid. Like, she's getting to play and imagine. I just really appreciate that. And the fact that she was able to talk about the importance of another character outside of her own. And with Janice, she's talking about Sister Charlotte. So, I wanted her, of all videos that I could have chosen, she was one because of her tie-in with Ouija. She's had horror experience, and I think she did a really good job. And then, of course, we do have some stuff about, from David F. Sandberg himself, about filming. So we can start playing that, and that's about being in the universe.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy.
He is.
Swedish.
Yeah.
Swedish born. Here we go.
Samara was awesome because she's...
That's B.
I mean, she's 8 years old, but she's a huge horror fan. So when I first met her, I was like, you know, Samara, that's actually the name of a famous horror character from The Ring. And she's like, yeah, I know. I love that movie. I'm actually named after her. It's like, oh, okay. And she was... I mean, when we were shooting Annabelle 2, Conjuring 2 just came out. And she went and saw that like 5 times in the theaters. Like, she's a huge horror fan. So when James, one day when James came by the set, that was like the highlight for her to actually meet him. And she was always like, I'm wanting to do more horror stuff in the movie and like asking me like, hey, can't you let me do this or do that? Because she was so into it.
Yeah.
And she's only eight.
I think
eight.
What makes Annabelle creepy, besides the fact that she looks pretty creepy, is that James just did such a great job with setting her up in that first Conjuring. So now she has this kind of feeling of dread attached to her, which is like, you know, seeing this movie in theaters, you see that people, like, they react as soon as she comes up on screen. And even on the set, it was like actors like Stephanie who was like, do I have to touch the doll? Like, I don't want to touch it. So I think that's a credit to James to having really created this mythology around.
And then he goes on to talk about this
universe.
I think
it's very exciting how this is evolving, you know, from just The Conjuring to now the Annabelle franchise, and now it's going into The Nun as well. And it's fun how they all go together. And you know, there is this established timeline, how they all piece together. And it's fun how, like, The Conjuring has this more investigative aspect, you know, since it's based on the Warren files, while Annabelle, while still being based on the real doll, is a little bit more freer in that it's not based on any particular events. So you can sort of go a little bit more crazy in the scares department, I think.
And crazy they do. I want to bring something up about the doll, too. Remember I talked about the difference between horror and camp, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're in the second movie of Annabelle, 2.5. Let's throw it into The Conjuring, right? Well, there's another famous horror doll outside of Saw, Chucky, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, one could argue that the first Child's Play movie is a good horror budget, horror movie. It's a good B horror movie. I would argue, but you know, as the sequels went along, Chucky just became campy, and the movies weren't as scary. You were just waiting to hear what Chucky had to say, what quip he was going to throw out, right? So, but with Annabelle, you know, thus far anyways, you're keeping to the true disparate that's in this doll, which can further the horror. So it's a good example of where camp and horror, like, what's really true camp, and you're using a doll. So that's why I wanted to bring that up. So
I will never buy anyone a doll. I do not want one in my house. That's what I will say.
How about an action figure?
No.
They're not dolls. You know, and what I really, too, and I think you can get a sense of this, too, is that they did 80-90% of all of the effects in camera.
Yeah. Like, I mean, to be honest, I couldn't even tell. You know, I was trying to go through it, like, what realistically would be CG'd.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the only thing I can think of was maybe some of the transformation of the doll walking. The actual possession of the squid ink, the black mist. You know, but David Sandberg, and again, he used... It's all about lighting, negative space. Did the same thing in Lights Out, you know, and he even says, even with the best CGI in the world in horror, you can still sense that there was something there. People saw and reacted to it. And he's right. Like, if you're relying on that, you can sort of kind of tell.
No.
Where a practical in-camera effect, I think it helps build the suspense a lot better. And Sandberg goes on to say, and again, he's a, like Juan, he also likes to do long, unbroken takes. So we did a lot of camera moves that for that nice transitions between scenes. And Sandberg and his cinematographer, he just went on to say about him, Maxim has a lot of experience in horror space. So it's fun just showing up on the day and discussing with him how we could do the shot the best way, much like you said, without having it fully storyboarded out. And I think it works to effect very well.
That, you know, one of my favorite shots was when she kind of gets dragged. You know, it's a tale of two halves. One's bright, well, not bright, as little light as possible, but still seeing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just complete darkness, this hallway, and, you know, the spatial relations, like, they continually change. You know, what seemed like a short distance now becomes, you know, you might as well be climbing Mount Everest, in essence. And they were able to utilize that so well in that sense. And I think, you know, it just makes it so much, for me, I know when I shoot movies, it just makes it A, fun, B, so much simpler because I get to see, okay, I know how this is going to fit as opposed to, okay, we shot some blue screen stuff,
Right.
Now let's hope that they get it right.
But I'm glad you brought up the dragged scene because let's be honest. At this point, the drag scene, since movies like Paranormal Activity, you know, people getting dragged, it's become very cliche. I mean, Jesus, you see it in the trailer in Flatliners. It's like, oh, somebody's getting dragged across the floor again.
I can't wait. That's, oh my God. I can't believe they made that. But
don't
anyway.
Even, don't get me started. But in this movie, they took the cliche, but with some style and a little bit of finesse, they still made it look different.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. It's predicated, they set that up, you know, we're using the chair now as a device, and it comes right after that, right? We're going through this whole suspense of, I got to get down. Wait, what happens if I get down? Like, I got to just stay somewhere in the middle. Oh, now the clicker doesn't work anymore. Oh, wait, because I got to buckle myself in because that was the thing. Oh, no, that doesn't work either. Crap.
Yeah. Knowing how to build suspense. And using a James Wan, using another James Wan technique, right? That's horrific enough. What I've always appreciated about James Wan is he goes to what we as an audience think would be the typical scare. Camera wipes up. There's a creature up on the dresser. Oh my God, that's scary. But then the creature lunges. It does that extra move. He does that extra move that makes you jump even higher. You're like, you're still in midair from the first jump, and then you're up on your legs. That scene is, she goes up. I mean, and it's logical, like, where else is she going to go? Oh, my God, and when she got dropped. Well, it's just, they just take the conventional and make it unconventional, and that's what makes a movie like Annabelle Creation scary. I want to talk a little bit, too, because I think it's cool. Costuming, if we could. Leia Butler, who is the costume design, her biggest challenge on this was finding the right type of polio brace for the actor, Talitha Bateman, who played Janice, that suited the period. And at first, they thought they had found the perfect brace on eBay, but when they received it, it was about half the size they needed it to be. And eventually they were able to find an authentic braces, but had to manufacture the shoes so that it fitted at the time. But catch this, the real vintage find of the movie, believe it or not, was the wheelchair that she was in. Catch this, it was purchased at auction, and it had belonged to none other than the creator of Tarzan, Edgar Rice Burroughs. That's sort of cool. I like that. That's sort of kind of cool trivia right there.
Absolutely.
You know? And again, you can tell that that's the problem. On set, you can say, oh my God, this chair was Edgar Wright Burroughs' chair. Which, again, you took another wheelchair scene that was really scary.
No.
And not only was it scary, it took place outside. It took place in broad daylight when she was outside. And all of a sudden, you see a nun's hands grab her chair and start wheeling her into the farmhouse. I mean, that's in broad daylight, and you can't see who it is because your initial thought is that it's Sister Charlotte. That ain't no Sister Charlotte.
Well, even I like that, you know, I love that it was broad daylight and they played with that because you kept trying to see it. Right. But the way the sun, yeah. You know, I mean, it's very true. You know, when the sun's in your eye, you can't see anything. And obviously that's where her head is, where the sun was.
Yeah.
And that was a brutally painful scene to watch.
It really was. And so well done. And then they take something else that should be innocent, a scarecrow. And that scarecrow was scary. It was even the way they set it up. You're like, if you go to horror movies a lot, you go, yeah, he's coming back. In some way, shape, or form, that thing's going to like scare the crap out of me. And the way that it was utilized was pretty awesome.
Indeed.
Yeah, that could have been some CG as well.
I want to switch to editing a little bit.
Sure.
Because, obviously, we talk about the importance of editing, and there's times where we just don't really give it praise because it's, in a sense, it's so kind of part of the movie that it gets lost, which is good. I mean, that's the irony of it all.
Yeah, when it's seamless.
And, you know, I thought the editing worked really well. Now, part of it, as we've been highlighting, is the cinematography because he was able to hold shots.
Right.
But what I thought his name is Michael Aller.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting kind of career. I want to highlight. I don't know him. I couldn't really read his bio, but just on his quote resume, he's done movies such as Big Fish, Jack the Giant Slayer, Eat, Pray, Love, and that was kind of just as part of the editorial department.
Right.
And now he's really sort of stepping into horror with movies like Lights Out, The Boy Next Door. And what I appreciate is he seems like he was willing to just jump in. I mean, these are amazing movies, so as he should have.
Right.
And he learned a lot from just being able to be a part of those. And it's interesting now him applying it to a horror genre. Because I thought he did wonderful.
Yeah, I think so, too. And Marissa, when she's here as well. But we always talk about timing. We talk about editing. We talk about it in comedy because it's very important. But in horror, editing is extremely important because, we're going to get from one scene to another. But editing along with, it's the troika. You've got your director, your cinematographer, and your editor, right? And, of course, your performances. But it's all about piecing this together. And it's like, how are we going to pace this horror movie, right? And when do we let the audience breathe, if that's the case, how we're going to do it? And if we're going to deliver a scare, how are we going to do it? It is all in the timing. It's how long do we make the audience languish, like in suspense, before we punch them in the gut or drop them off that first drop of a roller coaster? And that's all in editing. It's a dance. It's like... And editing leads to suspense. If you're cutting from, like, you in the wheelchair scene, it's making sure you have your pickup shots of her. Oh, I don't have it plugged in. And then it's the button. And then it's like, I'm going up, I'm going down. A lot of that pacing is done by, that suspense is brought through the editing. It's how quick are we going to do it? And he was great because I always got a sense, like, of how the peril was building, such as you said, in the scene where she's grabbed by the chair, you know, and pushed into the farmhouse. You know, when something is going to jump, how long did I wait for that? Or when is something going to come out from the dark? So he did. You're right. He did a great job. And I think Lights Out too. Is a testament to...
I think he did a great job with that.
Very good job.
Benjamin Walshfish did the soundtrack for this, and quietly... You know, we talk a lot about all these fantastic composers. He is sort of an unsung hero as I look back on it. Golden Globe and Emmy-nominated composer... spans over 60 films. movies such as Atonement... 12 Years a Slave, did a short film called Auschwitz, which you can tell by the title of the subject matter there. Recently did a cure for wellness. So it's done quite a bit.
Think about the movies, to the titles that you just mentioned outside of, we'll get into Annabelle for a second. Each one of the movies that you just talked about is about tone. Okay. So that's why he's an unsung hero, because his soundtracks aren't necessarily, they're a bed. They accompany the movie. They help the movie go along. But his soundtracks really are about setting a tone for what you're watching. Okay. They may not be the soundtracks that you would go out and buy and put in your iPod or whatnot or stream. But when you look at Annabelle Creation, his music never overpowered the movie. Again, sometimes, and again, in those horror movies that aren't so good, they rely so much on music where the music drowns out anything that's happening on screen. And now you can tell it's just a cheap way to deliver a scare, is when you have music come in really loud at a certain scene and it's over. Not so much in Annabelle. Yeah. It worked very well in setting tone and setting suspense and setting scares.
Yeah.
So, you know, he when you're looking for tone, you go to this guy. He's good.
He's
good.
You know, I've never really... We didn't cover Cure for Wellness. We did 12 Years a Slave, I believe.
We did, and
that was such a long time ago at this point. But
actually,
yeah, we did.
That was... we had a great, great time on that one. It was a great discussion. 12 Years a Slave. If you've seen it, go and watch it, because it really is a poignant discussion of that movie, I think. So,
yeah.
But he did a good job.
So I'm looking forward to seeing his name on a few other things
sure.
as well. So I'm looking forward to being able to put him on our mantle of
Absolutely.
Other great composers, whether in Ottman or... Gianchino and so mm-hmm. forth.
Alexander Desplat.
Yes.
Oh. Zimmer.
He's just Zimmer. interestingly enough, this movie was supposed to come out a lot earlier, but it got switched because of Alien Covenant.
Right.
So it got pushed back a lot. But I think it plays to its... I think they did a good job of doing it.
Oh, it's a perfect release date. You know, the latter half of this summer has proven to give me personally, just my own personal, like perhaps like the most entertaining, like good movies. Like I've been having, like there was Alien Covenant's one. I had fun with Guardians. Wonder Woman came out earlier in the summer. But a lot of the movies that are at the beginning, maybe not so much as good, but starting with Baby Driver and going forward, there hasn't been movies where I've gone outside of Dark Tower. There have been fun movies. And this is a really good horror movie, and I think it came out at the right time. I think we need good horror movies. There hasn't really been good horror to come out this summer.
42 Meters Down was more suspense,
mm-hmm.
And that's a shark movie, and just timing never worked out, but you and I both saw it and enjoyed it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I can't think of other ones.
No, there hasn't been and we're going into a season where we are going to get more horror movies. Like, I can't wait for it. But this movie, I think, comes out at a right time. It's great. It's been getting people out. I mean, as of August 17th, this movie with a $15 million budget, okay? And this is, it's a $15 million budget. All in, they probably spent not that much more than $50 to $60 million all in. Marketing, hard drives, advertising. They did a good job marketing the movie. And it's 48 million plus, $48.5 million domestically. Foreign, it's done 53 million. So worldwide box office, it's over $100 million already.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a lot of spondulics when you're talking a $15 million budget. Which is good, because it's good for horror. It says there can be flair and it can scare you. And it means we're going to get more in this Conjuring universe. But it's also great for Sandberg and company and for Juan, because he could probably go off and do another type of a horror movie, come back and do, I know Maxime Alexander is working on The Nun, this Varick, the Valak character. So, I think Thus far, they're doing pretty good. It gets a 68% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Which isn't, I mean, for horror movies, it's bad.
Yeah, I think. For a horror movie, 68% is better than usual. I would have,
I think a 78 would have been more effective.
78, for me. Here's where I was a little bit surprised. CinemaScore was a B. I would have expected from the audience participation A minus. Like this is better than a B movie.
Yeah.
You know, at least for my who likes horror movies. This again is far better than the first Annabelle movie, and it delivers all around. And it gives you, it's not your typical horror movie. It wasn't even shot like your typical horror movie. It sort of kind of had European flair to it, and it let the story unfold. We had scares throughout. Of course, the last 20 minutes of this movie are pretty much like in your seat. What the hell is happening here? But I don't know. I give it a higher grade than a B.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, if this is just the most random joke, but the people I went to see it with a couple people, one who was really looking forward to see it, one who had no idea what this was. I just said, hey, want to see Annabelle? And luckily, I got on the phone and someone asked me, what am I doing? I said, seeing a horror movie. And he was just shocked. He's like, wait, I thought it was a musical. So thank God he learned that beforehand.
Oh my God.
True story. True story.
Do I know this person?
Yes, you do. Anyway.
You'll tell me off camera this person is so I can. Musical.
Oh, yeah, good God. I don't know.
Well, I had a...
maybe he thought it was a sequel story to, like, Annie or something.
I'm just going to put this plea out to people. For those of you who watch us and you have kids, if your kids don't like horror movies, don't take them. I sat next to a woman who took two kids who were younger or about as young as the girls in this movie. And one of them just was not having it. And the woman just kept on yelling.
I
could
see why.
Of course. And this is what I actually, if the movie itself wasn't horrific, these words will horrify you. Just close your eyes and go to sleep. Those are the words that were echoed. And I'm like, are you effing kidding? Through this, she's already traumatized and she's going to go to sleep. That's your, she finally took her out of the theater. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. Look, I can't parent your kids. I don't know what they like. There are some 8-year-olds,
who
love horror movies.
Well, find that out at home. Maybe see a couple movies.
Find
at home.
Find it out at home. Don't do it in a movie theater. Which, by the way, is the theater I saw it in. Holy cow, the sound was awesome in this too.
Absolutely.
You know, it was really, really good stuff.
One of the interesting things before we start wrapping things up, David, what he says, I've been thinking about fun franchises. New Line has Nightmare on Elm Street and Critters. Might be fun if you took something like that in a different direction with previous installment. Instead of remaking Nightmare, you do some continuation of it in the same kind of world. So, in terms of mindset, that's what he's kind of thinking about. So it'll be interesting to see what he does now.
Yeah, it would be. I think, and he likes the horror genre. He said he'd be more than happy to continue to work in the horror genre and at the same time maybe do something else. Where you might not think of him because he's now plunked into horror, but I'm willing to bet that he could have a good sense of comedy timing. Right. Take a chance. Why not? But it would be interesting. I mean, I know New Line already took a crack at rebooting Nightmare on Elm Street, and it really didn't work. It didn't deliver the scares. Look, I think that if you can deliver, if you want to do Nightmare on Elm Street, we'll talk about that. You want to do that, number one, you get a director like him who gets it, right? And you make the scares primal. That's what made the Wes Craven original scary. You got to make it primal. But he's a guy that could, I think that he could pull it together.
From what it sounds like and from his current track record.
Yeah, absolutely. And see Lights Out if you haven't seen it.
Check us out. We did a great interview with I won't say because check it out. Be surprised. No, it was the male lead.
I wasn't here. I missed out on that. Yeah. Well, I had other things going on.
I believe
on.
Mercer got to sit next to him, which was a treat for her.
Nice.
Anyway.
He's a good guy. Look, it's a good movie. It's a good horror movie.
Absolutely.
So you could see how David S. Sandberg, and the gentleman too, check out Ouija 2 Origin of Evil. Not only do you get to see Lulu scare the crap out of you, but it's a very well-directed movie. Again, yeah. So
we've done a lot of we've covered a lot of horror here on Anatomy, so definitely check out some past episodes as well, especially as Halloween is approaching. I know we're a little bit away, but it's approaching nonetheless.
Hey, but it is,
that'll be fun,
3 weeks away, if that. I cannot wait.
So we're going to certainly be talking about that. In the meantime, support Dimitri at DMovies1701.
Yep, please. If I may, just make this as short as possible. Look, folks, I love your support on Twitter. Many of you write me back, and we've actually had discussion about movies, and I love that. I really do. 98% of my tweets are movie-related. I retweet a lot of movie stuff. With what's going on in the world today, I think the other 1%, 2%, I've tweeted some other stuff out, just about social things, and I know I'm a movie guy. If anything that I've tweeted out there has made you maybe not follow me anymore, well, number one, I don't want to lose followers. I want supporters, and I do want to keep the discussion going on movies, but there's been lots going on that I just feel I just have to shoot off a tweet or two. I try to be humorous, but then I'll always bring it back to movies. So I don't mean to lose supporters. I don't mean I don't mean to be political, so to speak. If you can endure the 1% of those tweets, I'd appreciate it. Stay on board. But if you so want to opt out, I understand, and I mean no offense. Well, so I just want to say that.
Hey, as always, you have the comments to respond to here for the videos and so forth, so definitely let us know. And if you're listening on iTunes or wherever, we appreciate you as well, so don't be afraid to
comment. Yeah, tell
as
us.
Well.
Oh, speaking of comments, I got something from Marissa. We got a comment earlier today from a Twitter follower who said, not a horror fan, but saw Annabelle 3 times. I dare you, Marissa, to see it once.
I didn't realize there was a third movie.
Well, she started three times. All right, folks, thank you.
And on that joke, thank you guys for joining us. At Movie Anatomy is our social media. This is the network Popcorn Talk. Tons of shows here. And, of course, for Anatomy of Movie specifically, tons and tons of episodes, both horror, both non-horror, for you to dive through, and plenty more to come. So stay tuned. Thank you guys, as always.
Thanks,
until next time.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.